Let's face it, in our busy lives, we don't eat enough fruits and vegetables. In fact, according to the CDC, only 1 in 10 Americans are eating the recommended daily amount of fruits and vegetables each day, missing out on essential vitamins, minerals, fibers, and antioxidants. And that's where Balance in Nature comes in. Balance in Nature sources only the best produce, free from pesticides, heavy metals, and harmful bacteria. And Balance in Nature is the best fruit and vegetable product on the market. They use only fresh whole fruits and vegetables inside each capsule. They don't use any GMOs, fillers, binding agents, or preservatives of any kind. You're getting real food, real science, real nutrition. I would never endorse a product that I don't use myself, and since using Balance in Nature, I feel more alert, I have more energy, my focus is sharper, and I feel great. Live life to the fullest and choose Balance in Nature. And guess what? PAS Report listeners can get 35% off the first preferred order. Start getting the recommended daily amount of fruits and vegetables you need by using code PAS at balanceofnature.com.
Welcome to the PAS Report Weekly Roundup Podcast. The PAS Report provides an honest analysis on the critical issues that matter to you without the biased media filters. Here's your host, Professor Nicholas Giordano.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the PAS Report Podcast. It's your host, Nick Giordano, and I hope your week is going well. I want to thank all of you who reached out to me about Monday's interview with Dr. Ben Carson. Remarkable man. He's genuine, down-to-earth, love and devotion to the United States, and he stands for everything the United States has to offer. I wish more public servants had his attitude. If you haven't yet listened to the episode, I suggest you do. I have links up at the PAS Reports. Check it out. Getting to today's episode, I want to focus on our military. You know, growing up in the 1980s and 1990s, we were spoiled. It was the pinnacle of American power. The American military was supreme. There wasn't a country out there that could realistically challenge us militarily. It was the most powerful, sophisticated, well-trained military the world has ever seen, especially coming off the heels of the 1991 Desert Storm victory. But like everything else, a lot has changed in the United States. And as America continues to decline in power and influence, so too does the military. Far more concerning is our military readiness is declining at the same time we're witnessing growing instability around the world. We are witnessing an increase in global threats, and understand this is not a coincidence. As a superpower declines in its power and influence around the world, including militarily, instability will always increase. That's International Politics 101, and we can use the levels of analysis to see just how the threats to American dominance continue to build up. However, I think the most frightening aspect is that it's all self-inflicted. The failures that we're seeing today is not the soldiers' fault, it's the leadership's fault, and it's all self-inflicted wounds. Our military readiness levels are at historic lows. We haven't been this unprepared since Vietnam, or maybe even since the 1930s, yet no one seems to care. You don't hear a lot of talk about this. Sure, in the last week we saw a lot of coverage about recruiting problems and issues, but it's far deeper than that. And given everything that's going on, the industrial media complex has ignored this story. Our military is unprepared for the rising threats in the 21st century. And many within the top brass care more about politics than actually winning wars. They don't care about meeting today's challenges. And I'm going to explain it all. Before I do, make sure to click the follow button so you never miss an episode of this podcast. Also, visit the PAS Report website, PASReport.com. And in the show notes, you'll find links to sourcing and all that fun stuff. Now, when you look at the current international environment and the lack of our military readiness, it is eerily similar to pre-World War II levels. It's almost like deja vu. If you've listened to this podcast since the start of the coronavirus, you may remember that in April of 2020, when the coronavirus was in its infancy, the world was locking down. I did an entire episode on what the post-coronavirus world order may look like. Since then, the PAS Report has gotten a lot of new listeners, and the audience continues to grow tremendously. So if you haven't listened to that episode, I suggest you do. Even if you did listen to that episode, it may be a good time to get a refresher on what I said. I want to emphasize that this episode was done at the start of the coronavirus. As a student and teacher of world politics and history, I was alarmed by what was going on, by what I was seeing. And I knew we needed to tread carefully. Unfortunately, the elitists completely ignore people like me because I'm not one of them. I'm not one of these failures that exist out there, the same people that have made every single bad foreign policy decision over the course of the last 30 to 40 years. But I spoke about the distribution of power within the international system and how this will alter that power. I explained that when the distribution of power gets disrupted, instability increases as other countries are going to compete to acquire that power. I spoke about the coming economic storm. This isn't rocket science. While all these morons were saying that the fundamentals of the economy are still good, the economy is fine, anyone with a brain knew that the governments determining what businesses are essential and which ones weren't, everyone knew that was going to be a disaster. Anyone with a brain that saw governments around the world inject tons of cash into their economies knew that there was going to be adverse effects. Anyone with a brain knew that manipulating economies usually doesn't work out well, and we've been doing that for quite some time. Anyone who understands anything about government, particularly ours, knew that governments, especially our Congress, don't have the creativity or the intelligence levels to think out of the box and use targeted stimulus effectively. Instead, they just threw money at the problem. I explained how the economic realities will be grim when all is said and done. Now, I will say I thought the economic pain would start a lot sooner than what we are currently witnessing. But all of this was largely predictable. And in that episode, I made comparisons to the Great Depression in the 1930s. I acknowledged how our economy and the world economy are very different than they were from the 1930s. But at the same time, there were similar parallels that we cannot ignore. I talked about how so-called democratic governments were assuming too much power and authority within their countries, how we would see a rise in internal civil unrest throughout the world. Countries that many thought were largely stable would be challenged to their core, and the governments would ultimately collapse. We are witnessing the beginning of this take hold. Just look at countries like Sri Lanka, Panama, Argentina. Look at several countries on the African continent, including Egypt and Nigeria. Look at what's happening in the Netherlands, Germany, and other developed countries. We're now seeing farmers' protests spread to other countries, including Italy. The situation in Europe is deteriorating, and it will only get worse as energy shortages increase. There is nothing more dangerous than surging costs of energy and food, and at the same time, you have energy shortages. As people's desperation increases, they begin to lash out. Political leaders, they're going to attempt to deflect blame in any which way they can, but that's only going to inflame tensions. It's a recipe for disaster. I talked about Putin and Russia's ambitions in the Ukraine. I talked about the growing threat and power of communist China. I explained military moves that were raising red flags to me. The variables leading up to World War II are different, but there are some parallels that we need to draw on. As power vacuums become more apparent, countries will compete to fill the void. That's what we're witnessing out there. And as the world stage becomes increasingly unstable, as the world stage becomes ripe for conflict, our military readiness is declining at the worst possible time. Not only is our military readiness declining, so is trust in the military. This is unheard of in my lifetime. The last time we saw trust in the military decline was during Vietnam. And this should raise red flags throughout our government, especially the pencil pushers in the Pentagon, but it seems that no one is taking this seriously. And we have to ask, why is our military readiness and trust in the military on the decline? It goes beyond the toxic woke BS that is being pushed on the soldiers. Now, I'm going to talk about that because that is impacting. But one of the main reasons trust in the military has declined is because of the debacle in Afghanistan. Afghanistan was a catastrophic failure. We spent 20 years in that hellhole to the tune of over $2 trillion. We lost nearly 2,500 brave service members, and over 20,000 service members were wounded. And some of those wounds were life-altering injuries. And for what? For what? Throughout the 20 years, the policymakers, the generals, the spooks, the diplomats, they were all telling the American people, we're making progress, that the Afghan government was stable, that the Afghan military and police forces would be able to hold their own with little support from us. Well, it turns out none of that was true, and they knew that. They lied. We now have the Afghanistan papers where our officials knew the war was unwinnable. Whether we pulled out in 2011 after bin Laden's death or in 2021, the country would not become this thriving beacon of democracy, which was always a dumb idea from the beginning, and the country would remain unstable. There's a reason Afghanistan is known as the graveyard of empires. Maybe the leaders, the ones that are making the decisions, maybe they should look into that and understand history. But in any event, this is why the generals, the spooks, the diplomats, they ramped up warnings to President Biden that if he withdrew, Afghanistan was going to collapse. Now, don't think for a second that they were operating in good faith. They weren't. Instead, they were in cover-their-ass mode. They knew exactly what was going to happen. They knew that their lies for over a decade were about to be exposed. After 20 years of war, the sole superpower of the world, the most technologically advanced military of the world, the best trained military of the world, announced our intent to withdraw. and the Taliban were able to retake control of that country in less than a week. In fact, the Taliban is better armed and equipped today than they were 20 years ago. It's friggin' embarrassing. We sacrificed so much, and for what? For what? This embarrassment? And who has been held accountable? Who? Name me a single person from the military, from the intelligence community, from the State Department, from the policymakers. Name me a single person that has been fired for this debacle. And the only person that was charged and punished was Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Scheller, because he had the nerve, the audacity, to publicly criticize the top military brass for the failures in Afghanistan and call for accountability. So the one person that was actually doing the right thing, he's the one that gets punished. All the other people responsible for these failures, they get to go on and live their lives. In fact, some of them even got promotions, only in government. You know, gone are the days of the General Pattons and the General MacArthurs. Instead, we have a bunch of incompetent people driving our military and our military readiness into the ground. And if you want to know why so many lost trust in the military, just look at Afghanistan. And that's one of the main reasons. We don't fight wars to win anymore. If you look at the last 70 years, ask yourself, how many wars have we won? And what I mean by won, I mean that we defined clear objectives, successfully met those strategic objectives, giving us the ability to actually declare victory. And when you actually think about it, the answer is one. One freaking war out of countless military engagements over the last 70 years. And the one victory was over Iraq and Saddam Hussein in the 1991 Persian Gulf War. That's it. Knowing that you have to ask why we don't fight wars to win anymore, that's a problem. We shouldn't have to ask that question. Sadly, I don't have an answer as to why we don't fight wars to win anymore. I know why we lose wars, but I can't explain why we don't fight to win wars. We lose wars because we attach political objectives rather than military objectives. It's important to know that while we do lose wars, we actually do win most of the military battles. We lose military engagements because we don't meet the political objectives of the conflict, because you've got a bunch of morons developing those objectives. Take Afghanistan. What were the overall objectives? Most people can't answer that question because they were never really defined. And then they morph. They morphed into creating a stable democratic country. But what the hell does that mean? What does a democratic Afghanistan even look like? You can't define that. You can't measure that. What about Iraq? Or what about the countless other countries we've been engaged in militarily over the last several decades? What about it? The reason we were able to declare victory in the first Desert Storm War in 1991 is that we had smart objectives, objectives that were simple, measurable, attainable, realistic, and timely. The objective was simple. It was to repel Saddam's forces from Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and destroy his military capabilities so he couldn't do another invasion. You don't need to be a rocket scientist to understand those objectives. They were pretty simple. These objectives were easy to measure, as we could see in real time Saddam's forces surrendering and withdrawing. The objectives were attainable. We did it in 43 days, so I would say that was pretty timely, and the objectives were certainly realistic. And notice how it wasn't about overthrowing a government, it wasn't about nation building, it wasn't about this idea of democracy. You would think that we would be focusing on our own failures over the last several decades, especially after the embarrassment of Afghanistan. I mean, that's clear as day. You spend 20 years in a place and that's the way it ends. You need to come back and figure out what went wrong. But no, of course not. Why do that? Why do that? That would be too much common sense. See, the powers that be in this country are never held accountable, and they don't see themselves as failures. Many of these frauds actually think that they're the greatest thing since sliced bread. Don't ever underestimate the ego of a politician, a government bureaucrat, or the academic elite. Don't ever underestimate it. Just take General Milley. He played a major role in overseeing the training of the Afghan army. He failed. Instead of getting fired, he got promoted. That's a government thing. That doesn't happen in the private sector. That only happens in government. Only in government can you repeatedly fail, but you still get promoted because you know how to play the political game. They ignore and wash their hands of their failures as if the failures never existed. And it's not just the military. Look at the intelligence community. Remember Iraq had weapons of mass destruction? Remember how we've been wrong every step of the way when it came to North Korea's nuclear progression? We continually said that they were behind, that they weren't going to be able to develop nuclear weapons for years, for decades. Well, it turns out that North Korea and their nuclear program was light years ahead of where we assessed them to be. It turns out that their missile programs were light years ahead of where we assessed them to be. We were surprised at the achievements of China and Russia when it comes to hypersonic weaponry. What about China's growth and the sophistication of the Chinese intelligence apparatus, infiltrating all aspects of our society, especially college campuses? They obviously missed that one. Part of the reason I decided to do this episode was because of my discussion with Professor Adam Elwanger a few weeks ago. You would think, like, the failures are so glaring, they're so obvious, that more people would want to actually talk about them and figure out what the hell is going on. Imagine that, focusing on our failures. And they should also be focusing on a very concerning survey that raises several alarm bells. Our military is made up of an all-volunteer force. Those who willingly decide to enlist, and they do it knowing that at any moment they could be sent to war and pay the ultimate sacrifice. Most people joining the military today do so for the love of country. They are patriotic individuals. They are willing to put their lives on the line to protect this nation. They also sign up for the opportunities the military affords them, from traveling and seeing the world, you get specialized training, get the GI Bill, you could attend college. Well, the Military Family Advisory Network surveyed current members of the military and veterans, and they run this poll every 2 years. In the survey, they were asked if they would recommend military life to others. In 2019, 74.5% of respondents said they would recommend the military and military service. In 2021, there was a 20-point swing. The percentage that would recommend declined by 11.6 percentage points, and there was a 10% upswing in those who would not recommend military service. Now, 8,638 people participated in this survey, so that's a wide sample. And one of the main reasons they gave was the long separations from family. Understand that when it comes to deployments, we have asked so much more of our soldiers in today's day and age than in previous generations. Many of the soldiers today went on 4, 5, 6 different tours. Some went on as many as 10 tours of duty in some of the harshest places in the world. That's unheard of. If you think back to World War II, the majority of soldiers served 1 or 2 tours. So we have placed enormous burdens on today's soldiers, and it's taking its toll. I also have zero doubt that those that served tours in Afghanistan and Iraq are pissed about how we withdrew from Iraq in 2011, how we withdrew from Afghanistan in 2021. They probably feel that all their hard work was for nothing. All their sacrifices down the tubes because bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. and failed leadership. Another problem is that when there is rising inflation, it's devastating to military families. Imagine you're a soldier. You're making between $20,000 to $30,000 a year. If you're deployed in a combat zone, you get a nice little stipend extra every month of $225. Wow, big whoop. It's ridiculous. If you're an officer, you're going to make between $35,000 and $50,000. Sure, they get other benefits. I'm not denying that. But when you're in an inflationary period and struggle to put food on the table, it becomes a major financial burden on the family unit. Many people are completely unaware of how some of our soldiers, these are people currently enlisted, how some of them have to actually use social welfare benefits. And I want you to think about that. These are people who are doing their patriotic duty, putting their lives on the line, something most of us never do. And they have to go on federal assistance programs like food stamps and welfare? Because when you factor in their spouse and children, they fall below the poverty line?
Come on, man!
That's shameful. And maybe the military should focus on that because it's certainly impacting our military readiness. That would actually make sense. But most of those in leadership, they don't have the common sense to look at something like that. Instead, they operate in the world of theory. Then they wonder why we are having recruitment issues, right? And then you look at military readiness. It's important to look at our military equipment. And many of you are completely unaware. Again, it's largely because of our media. So many aren't paying attention to our dwindling military hardware supplies. The Congressional Budget Office issued a report earlier this year that our aircraft availability has declined within the Air Force and Navy. Flying hours per aircraft also fell considerably. So what's going on here? According to the report, aircraft availability declined from 60% in 2000 to less than 45% in 2020. Flying hours declined from an average of 300 hours per year to about 230 hours per year. The numbers of fighter and attack planes dropped from 200 hours per year to 125 hours per year. We have fewer aircraft available. Our pilots are getting less flying time. At the same time, we're seeing the rise of Communist China, as Communist China continues to make advances both in air and on the seas, and they have completely modernized their military. So keep that in mind. In another survey, this one conducted by the Army, 14% of respondents said their unit would be ready to deploy, fight, and win anywhere in the world at a moment's notice. Again, think about that number. 14% of respondents said their unit would be ready to deploy, fight, and win anywhere in the world at a moment's notice. How frightening is that? Now, of that 14%, 20% of warrant officers were confident that their unit could win today, while 40% of generals said they were confident that they could immediately deploy and win. First of all, it's scary that only 40% of generals actually felt this way. I mean, that's insane. If I'm a general and I'm in charge of the military, I have a leadership role within the military, and I don't believe that our soldiers are ready to deploy, fight, and win anywhere in the world, that's a problem. And according, you have 60% of generals that obviously felt this way. Secondly, it's even more concerning that 20% of warrant officers actually believe that we could deploy, fight, and win anywhere in the world. It shows a major disconnect. And I'll actually go with the warrant officers, because the warrant officers, so that means 80% of the warrant officers surveyed don't believe that's true. Warrant officers are the ones that are actually on the battlefields. The generals are far away. They're insulated. So I trust the opinions of the warrant officers more because they're on the ground. So consider that 80% of warrant officers that were part of the survey didn't believe that we could deploy, fight, and win a war anywhere in the world at a moment's notice. In another assessment report, 58% of brigade combat teams were at the highest levels of tactical readiness. Now, Army policy is that 65% of brigade combat teams should be at the highest levels of tactical readiness. Even worse than the number is that it's down 16 percentage points from the year before, when the number stood at 74% of our brigade combat teams were at the highest levels of tactical readiness. That's a huge drop-off. So we see the deficiencies in our military readiness. And then what about our weapon systems and their availability? Having stockpiles of weapons is essential to ensuring military readiness, right? That's common sense again. Now, I'm going to say something that you're not supposed to say. And if you bring it up, you're declared an agent of Russia, a stooge for Putin. But something that's getting very little attention is how we are rapidly depleting our stockpiles of weaponry because we've given so much military hardware to the Ukrainians. And here are just a few examples. We have sent over 25% of our shoulder-fired Stinger missiles to Ukraine. Raytheon Technologies makes these weapons, and the CEO stated that they will not be able to ramp up production until next year because of part shortages. It's estimated that if we continue on the current trend of what we're giving, we can completely deplete our inventory of Stinger missiles. When it comes to the Javelin weapon systems, you've heard a lot about those. We sent over a third of our Javelins, 7,000, to the Ukraine. We produce about 600 to 800 Javelins a year, so do the math. And again, it's not like we could just ramp up production and we could just, you know, increase the stockpiles relatively quickly. We still have the ongoing supply chain issues. The Javelins use more than 200 semiconductors, the same semiconductors that are already in short supply. We are seeing shortages even down to the most basic level, artillery shells. This is a disaster. And when asked about this, what is the top brass of the military say? Many of them have stated that this has no impact on our military readiness. No impact whatsoever on our military readiness. Are you kidding me? How am I supposed to take these fools seriously when they say such obvious untruths and outright lies? Of course it has an impact on our military readiness. Now, if our military leaders aren't focusing on these real military deficiencies that we have and the lack of military readiness, we have to ask, where are they focusing their attention? And the answer, relatively simple. White supremacy, white rage, diversity, inclusion, and equity, of course. This is what they want to focus on.
Should a member of the organization you lead be treated differently, in violation of the Constitution, I would add, based on their sex or the color of their skin?
No, I do not believe that. And that is why we have diversity, equity, and inclusion focused in the military.
And the military for decades has been one of the institutions in the society where you are most likely to get ahead based on your own performance, on your own merit, irrespective of the color of your skin or where you came from or who your parents were.
Sir, I absolutely agree with that, and I am an example of that.
Your distinguished career is an outstanding.
But I would also say that,
Mr. Secretary, your career is an excellent example of that.
So here you have the Secretary of Defense, who by his own admission explains how the military is not supposed to have race-based protocols and that you achieve merit through hard work, competition, and success, the way it's supposed to be done. But in the same breath, he's talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and the dropping of standards. So it doesn't make too much sense. Then you have General Milley, who has this to say.
But I do think it's important, actually, for those of us in uniform to be open-minded and be widely read. And the United States Military Academy is a university. And it is important that we train and we understand. And I want to understand white rage, and I'm white. And I want to understand it.
Everything that guy just says is bullshit. Thank you.
These are the people in charge of our military. Remember when the Secretary of Defense issued a 60-day stand-down order to investigate white supremacy and the right-wing extremism that was prevalent throughout the military? For years, pencil pushers in the bureaucracy have been warning about this growing threat, the growing number of soldiers that are susceptible to white supremacy and extremist activities. But it's even worse than that when you consider this statement by the Secretary of Defense.
The job of the Department of Defense is to keep America safe from our enemies. But we can't do that if some of those enemies lie within our own ranks.
I want you to consider that for a minute. Imagine you're in the military, and the leader of the military says that the enemy has infiltrated the military. Think about what that does. Would you begin to start to look at other soldiers with suspicion, wondering if they're one of these enemies? Not sure who you can trust and who you can't. Then you get all this racial garbage being shoved down their throats. You join the military, knowing of the potential that you may eventually pay the ultimate sacrifice. But the top leadership views you as a possible white supremacist, a right-wing extremist, an enemy. Think about how destructive that is within the military. I mean, first of all, if you're white, you may begin to grow bitter and resentful given that you're sacrificing so much. And what's the point of doing that if the powers that be are looking at you with suspicion? Now your character is being called into question, not because of anything you've done, but simply because of the color of your skin. And then think of the distrust it sows in the military. If I'm black or Hispanic, and my military leadership is telling me about all these white supremacists that have infiltrated the military, how is this going to impact my relationship with my peers? Am I going to start to look at them, that they may be white supremacists, radical extremists? Does this do anything for military cohesiveness? Think about the effects it has on recruiting. If I'm a minority and you're telling me that there is a growing number of white supremacists in the military, why am I going to join that military? Do you think I'm going to be more likely to volunteer, potentially sacrificing my life, or less likely? So why would anyone want to join an organization like that if you really believe that there's all these white supremacists in the military? But see, they don't think of things like that. Instead, they make these general blanket statements, consequences be damned. They make these statements because it's popular with the fringe within this country. We heard a lot about this growing threat of white supremacy and right-wing extremism in our military. It was so bad that the Secretary of Defense gave a 60-day stand-down order throughout every branch of the military to address extremism in the ranks. And it took them a year, nearly a year, to look into every soldier and their activities to determine whether or not it crosses the threshold of extremism or white supremacy. So after nearly a year of investigating, what did they uncover and why didn't you hear about it? I mean, when Secretary Austin issued the stand-down order, that made big news. Every news channel, every news outlet covered it, segment after segment, talking about the growing threat of white supremacy in the military. So you would think after nearly a year of investigating this, the media would be interested to know how widespread the problem is. They would be interested to know what are the results from this investigation. You would think that this growing threat of white supremacy would be big news, right? And then it would validate what a horrible nation we are. But you didn't hear anything about the results. You didn't hear anything about the report was issued. Why not? It wasn't reported on except by a few press outlets. Even when you try and search for it on Google or Yahoo, it's nearly impossible to find them. Try it and you'll see almost every headline that pops up is about the initial stand down order. Nothing about the results of that stand down order and investigation. Just about every mainstream outlet ignored this story. And the few that did report on it, of course, they put their spin on it. They put in a disclaimer that the number is probably higher because of challenges collecting data. We have nearly 2.5 million people serving in the United States military, both active duty and reserves. On Monday, December 20th, 2021, Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby announced that following the stand-down order in the investigation, nearly 100 troops were discharged for participating in, quote, prohibited extremist activities, end quote. Out of 2.5 million people serving, 100 troops were found to be discharged for prohibited extremist activities. 100 out of 2.5, I'm going to keep on repeating it, 100 out of 2.5 million were bad seeds engaging in extremist activity. Now, we have no idea what the extremist activity was because no one asked that. God forbid we ask those questions, and the press secretary never explained it. But I would like to know the specifics, especially the number of troops that engaged in white supremacist ideology. I would like to know that, given that we keep on hearing so much about this growing threat of white supremacist ideology infecting the military. So 100 out of 2.5 million. Of course, one is too many, and I'm not justifying it. We need to make sure that our military remains the most professional and colorblind military in the world. We need to make sure that the extremist elements are caught, rooted out, and discharged from our military. However, their reckless words and proclamations, they slandered the entire armed forces of the United States. There is little doubt that the reckless statements, the generalizations, lowered morale. And there were no apologies for the irresponsible rhetoric. Instead, it was swept under the rug and you haven't heard anything since. Every branch of the military is suffering from recruitment issues, and this is part of the reason. Why are you going to re-enlist in a military that doesn't appreciate the sacrifice that you're making, and you ain't going to become rich being a soldier? Understand that this CRT, critical race theory, and this diversity, inclusion, and equity nonsense, it destroys everything that it touches. It's a poison. It's toxic. And the military's move towards wokeism is a big reason for that. You factor in obesity and mental health problems plaguing our society, it's like the perfect storm when it comes to recruitment efforts. There was a great piece written by Douglas McKinnon and published in The Hill where Mr. McKinnon explains how the military has dramatically watered down its high physical, mental, and accountability standards. And I have the link to the article in the show notes, so I encourage everyone to read it. But he reminds the readers how not too long ago, in 2016, the CDC warned how the obesity epidemic was impacting our national security, that 71% of young people in the United States would not be able to join the military if they wanted to because they are obese. And I can imagine that this was in 2016, so I could imagine this number has increased since then. The CDC also stated that, quote, overweight and obesity status among active duty service members has risen by 73%, end quote, between 2011 and 2015. Another number that has probably grown significantly since last count. But dropping standards isn't helping the United States. It's not helping our military readiness. It's not helping our national security. And as the world becomes more unstable and 21st century threats continue to rise, we need to be on our A game. Sadly, our leaders are more consumed with proper pronoun usage than winning wars. It's a pathetic display. It's hard to watch as the greatest fighting force ever developed becomes a shell of what it used to be. It's scary to imagine that we are now becoming a laughingstock among our adversaries. It's an embarrassment. We should want our all-volunteer force to be the best with no exception. If we continue down this path, our military readiness will continue to suffer. And it'll only be a matter of time before we have to transition from an all-volunteer force to a mandatory military service, which will only make the problem worse. Ultimately, it will lead to the collapse of the military. And the military leaders pushing politics over winning wars, they should be fired immediately. Have some self-respect. Those pushing this poison in the military are the real extremists, and continuing down this path won't do any of us any good. The people in the Pentagon are completely out of touch with reality. Just think logically. Do you think proper pronoun usage is really going to matter if our military is defeated by a country like Communist China? We need to wake up. And we need a complete overhaul of the leadership within this country. And I'm talking about every single agency, every single department, everything. We need a complete overhaul. We need to refocus, rethink what our priorities are. We need to go back to the roots of limited government. Get rid of all this waste. Get rid of all these useless people that exist within our bureaucracy. I'm talking about both elected officials and the unelected bureaucrats. If you wanted a blueprint on how to destroy the most powerful military in the world, you would do exactly the things that they're doing. Our adversaries are laughing. And the worst part is that this whole mess, it's all self-inflicted wounds. We are destroying ourselves. And hopefully more military leaders would stand up and speak out about what's taking place. It's only a matter of time before one of our adversaries really starts to challenge us. And if we can't even destroy and defeat the Taliban after 20 years, what happens when we're facing a much more formidable foe, a much more capable foe? What happens then? I hope you found the content of this episode informative, and that's why you have to share it with others. More people need to know about it. It's not being spoken about enough in the media. So share it with family, friends, on your social media accounts. Don't forget to give the PAS Report a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Take 30 seconds to write a review. I want to thank you for joining me, and I'll be back on Monday with another great episode of the PAS Report podcast.
Thank you for listening to the PAS Report Weekly Roundup Podcast.
Have a good one.
Bye. Be sure to rate, share, and subscribe to the podcast so you'll never miss an episode. Also, visit PASReport.com and follow us on Twitter @PASReport.